This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. A mass shooting always rekindles the gun debate. This time, it's coupled with a debate over how political rhetoric and conspiracy theories may have helped inspire a man to attack a Pittsburgh synagogue last Saturday. Alongside the arguments over why this happened, we've been getting to know who was lost in that shooting. Bernice and Sylvan Simon, they were married at the Tree of Life Synagogue back in 1956. Rose Mallinger, a beloved mother and grandmother. Melvin Wax, an accountant who loved the Pittsburgh Pirates. Cecil and David Rosenthal, two brothers who acted as ambassadors of the synagogue. Irving Younger, a former Little League coach. Joyce Feinberg, a researcher who grew up in Toronto. Daniel Stein, a retiree and a dependable community volunteer. Richard Gottfried, a dentist and an interfaith marriage counselor. And Jerry Rabinowitz, a compassionate physician who would have surely been trying to save lives at the synagogue. How Pittsburgh and the nation are healing from these losses is just one story we'll explore today on the Friday News Roundup. Joining us here in studio is NPR's lead digital political reporter, Jessica Taylor. Jessica, welcome back to the Roundup.
Thanks for having me.
Wendy Benjaminson is the Washington Bureau managing editor of the newspaper company McClatchy. Wendy, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
And Naftali Ben-David is news editor at the Wall Street Journal. Naftali, thanks for making time for us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, as we mentioned, Pittsburgh continues to mourn after those 11 people were shot dead during Shabbat service at a synagogue last Saturday. Prosecutors say the gunman shouted, "All Jews must die," before opening fire. He's pleading not guilty to all 44 counts, including murder, hate crimes, and obstructing the practice of religion. The jury trial could result in the death penalty. Meanwhile, back-to-back funerals have been going on all week in Pittsburgh. Crowds have packed the services, there have been lines around the block, and nearby synagogues have sent busloads of congregants, and tonight is the first Sabbath since the shooting. Tree of Life Rabbi Jeffrey Myers had this message for those in Pittsburgh and in Washington.
It starts with everyone in this room, and I want to address for a moment some of our political leaders who are here. Ladies and gentlemen, it has to start with you as our leaders. My mother always taught me, if you don't have anything nice to say, say nothing.
Jeffrey Myers, rabbi at the Tree of Life in Pittsburgh. Wendy Benjaminson, let me start with you. We've been learning more about some of the victims who were laid to rest this week. Give us a sense of what we're learning about them. It seems that these are people who were very devoted, kind of essential members of the synagogue.
Absolutely. They also were involved in a group called HIAS, which works very hard to help settle refugees in this country. We don't know yet whether Robert Bowers knew that or picked the synagogue because of that, but certainly that added to the political factor. These are people who help settle refugees, and when you look at the rhetoric coming out now about against refugees and immigrants, that certainly heightens the pain of all of this.
Now, President Trump flew to Pittsburgh on Tuesday to pay his respects. Pittsburgh's mayor, Bill Peduto, had requested that he stay away until after the funerals. The president lit a candle, placed stones for the victims at the Tree of Life Synagogue. Naftali Ben-David, what kind of reaction did the president's visit get locally?
Well, like so much of what he does, the reaction was very divided and in some cases bitterly so. I mean, you have to say that for a lot of his trip, he did what a traditional president would do. He spoke words of people coming together. He was respectful at the sight of the mourning. But because of his general rhetoric and because of his overall political strategy, I think, of hitting very hard and very aggressively at people that he disagrees with, just his very presence there was divisive. And there were demonstrations and there were people who refused to appear with him. And it has to be said that after leaving, it didn't take him very long to lapse back into the kind of tone that people have criticized, talking about fake news, talking about his enemies, talking about immigrants. And I think that's why this was such a fraught event.
I do want to get more into that, too. But Naftali, the president also said that he didn't really see the protesters. He didn't really react to the people who were there who made it very clear that they didn't want him there.
Yeah, you know, afterwards he tweeted that, you know, the fake news media, one of his favorite terms, of course, had suggested that there were big demonstrations. And then he kind of minimized and dismissed the demonstrations as being small and far away. And he actually appended a unusual video to that tweet that almost looked like sort of a campaign video. It showed him on the morning site with music playing in the background. It sort of had a musical score. So, yeah, he tried to emerge from that visit with kind of a message that it had been sort of triumphal almost.
And speaking of the administration, Jessica, Press Secretary Sarah Sanders had a press conference this week before the president's visit that got contentious very, very quickly. At one point, she got into it with Jonathan Karl, who's with ABC News. She also got into it with CNN White House correspondent Jim Acosta. They got into a really testy back and forth about the president calling the media the enemy of the people.
The verbal assault against the president and everyone in this administration, and certainly we have a role to play, but the media has a role to play for the discourse in this country as well.
And sir, if I may follow up, excuse me, you did not say in the course of those remarks that you just made that the press is not the enemy of the people. Are we to take it from what you just said? We all get put through the ringer. We all get put in the meat grinder in this town, and you're no exception. For the sake of this room, the people who are in this room, this democracy, this country, all the people around the world are watching what you're saying, Sarah, and the White House for the United States of America, the President of the United States should not refer to us as the enemy of the people.
CNN White House correspondent Jim Acosta in a rather testy exchange with Press Secretary Sarah Sanders. Now, I wonder whether or not this changes, Jessica, the conversation about these exchanges. CNN's Christiane Amanpour had an interview with Jon Stewart and Dave Chappelle. They're doing a show in London. And Jon Stewart, who is not shy about skewering CNN, suggested that this is another sign of the press being part of the coarsening of the debate, that we're kind of playing into it as the president keeps calling us the enemy of the people.
I mean, CNN, I think, is in a unique position over the past week because they have been a target of some of these bombs that were sent by the man down in Florida that has since been arrested and things too. But, you know, I think that as journalists, our role is to cover it and just sort of push through it, I think. And, you know, he's going to continue to use this rhetoric, I think. The president, when he is attacked, he pushes back harder. He is not a the buck stops here type of person. He passes the buck. And I think the media is his foil. And we saw that, you know, when last week when these mail bombs were being sent out, these packages, these suspicious packages, you know, he did dial it back at his rally. But then by the end of the week, he was back to it. And, you know, I think that certainly, you know, as the president, he does have, I think, a higher responsibility for the type of rhetoric that he has. But Trump is going to be Trump. After 2 years, we know this. I don't think that it is going to change.
Wendy, did you want to jump in?
I was just going to add, yes, that it does hurt when the president of the United States calls, you know, your business, which is protected by the First Amendment, an enemy of the people. But I think Jon Stewart made an excellent point that we all need to listen to, that what we should be focusing on is the administration's policies and practices toward the country at large, not how he treats a few hundred reporters in Washington, D.C.
By the way,
we are not the story.
By the way, I should note, Naftali, how did Sarah Sanders respond to Jim Acosta? I think she just kind of brushed past that larger question where he's like, can you definitively say?
Yes, she did. And in fact, at one point, I believe it was him, was trying to get her to say, okay, who's the enemy of the people? Name one press organization. If you're going to go out and say this, then tell us specifically who it is. And her response was not to respond directly, but to say, you know what? It's outrageous the way the press is blaming the president for these shootings when only the shooter is responsible for the shootings. So it was just a situation of people talking completely past each other.
Kevin wrote on our Facebook page, I'm always frustrated how mass shooters take their own lives before they face justice. This cowardly and evil mass shooter will face justice here and now. That's something, anyway. We should mention that the gunman had his first court appearance this week. Jason wrote on our Facebook page, in cases like this where the crime doer is obvious, I think a not guilty plea shouldn't be an option. And Scott responded, I don't understand why he pleaded not guilty, but it's his right to do so. Jessica, do we have any sense of what the prosecution of this guy might look like? I mean, it seems, I would imagine they're fairly confident that they can convict him on at least a few of these charges.
I mean, I would certainly think so. I'm not a legal expert, but, you know, there are witnesses there that certainly saw him. He was apprehended. He shot other policemen that were responding to it. You know, it certainly seems like the evidence is fairly substantial, and that, I mean, you know, this is going to be a federal case as well. He's being tried on federal hate crime charges as well, and so I think that certainly that carries, you know, a larger burden. But I mean, he's facing the death penalty and very well could receive it.
Dem in Ohio tweeted, amidst all the bad news, the Muslim organizations raising funds to cover the cost of the Pittsburgh funerals was extraordinarily touching news, one any normal president would have acknowledged and praised. Instead, silence. Rachel tweeted, I grew up in Squirrel Hill, and this tragedy has impacted me greatly. We must turn our grief into action. It's imperative that lawmakers pass legislation to end gun violence and disarm hate, and that we vote as if our lives depend on it, because they do. One of the things that stood out, I'm glad Dem in Ohio and Rachel shared what they shared, because I don't know if the three of you have seen this, but unlike some of the previous mass shootings, I haven't heard much this week about rekindling the debate on gun policy. Like this, maybe it's just because we're so close to the midterms, but this week has really been about these wonderful people in Pittsburgh and what they did for their community, just as a sign that this community, Squirrel Hill, was kind of ready to extend a helping hand, Wendy, when this happened. I haven't heard anything about gun policy. I've just heard about how tremendous this neighborhood was.
That struck me as well.
Yeah.
I don't know whether we've just become inured to the debate that, yes, he used an AR-15 and we can have that argument again, but where both sides are hardened. It could be what you said, is that we're just before the election. But I think the way Pittsburgh as a city handled this was remarkable. The Islamic community in Pittsburgh, that move was really something else. And then followed, you know, with the Steelers showing up at all the funerals. It was really like, this isn't just the Jews in Pittsburgh. This is against Pittsburgh. And I think that was beautiful.
Jessica?
I mean, this was Mr. Rogers' neighborhood.
Literally.
You know, literally, this is where he settled. And I mean, I think that sort of that outpouring and just that thing that you feel, because you feel like you know these people. I think that, you know, they could have been the person that, you know, you went to for a doctor that you knew going in and out. You know, but we did see President Trump sort of in the immediate aftermath. He did say, you know, if they had been armed or something too. And, you know, in talking with my Jewish friends, they're used to their synagogues being armed on high holy days and different things like that too. I mean, you know, I as a white Christian, I haven't really experienced that in a lot of ways. And, you know, I think that's something that I've been struck by, that I've never really felt afraid at my church, but I understand that people of other faiths often do.
Yeah, I grew up Baptist, and mm-hmm. so I'm used to being Same. At churches where, yes. right, where we knew there were people in the congregation who were members of law enforcement.
Yes.
So we kind of figured, okay, you're probably armed, more than mm-hmm. likely, because you may have to go
yeah.
to work right after service.
Yeah, but there were never guards out front or things, you know?
Nothing like, that
yeah.
visible.
Yeah.
Nothing. So maybe kind of a wake-up call for
yeah, exactly.
for non-Jews in this country yeah. to what uh-huh. Jewish congregants go through on a regular basis.
But I also think one reason that we didn't hear more about the gun debate is we just got eclipsed by these broader conversations. I think there was a feeling right afterwards that where are we as a country? What is going on? We're so torn apart. I mean, this guy was very specific before he went in, talking about Jews and how horrible they were and how they were letting in invaders into the country that were going to destroy the country. And it echoed some of the other rhetoric we've seen. And it almost felt to me like, yes, there's the gun debate that's been around for a long time and is undoubtedly important, but there was this broader debate about our identity as a nation that kind of overcame all of that.
We should note that the president did not just resort back to his previous rhetoric immediately. Dave emailed, I saw a video showing Trump and family at the hospital visiting the injured. When he left, the staff thanked and praised him. I never heard anything about that from the mainstream media. I only heard how Pittsburgh didn't want him there. Lou tweeted, why isn't this guy being tried as a terrorist? I'd say the people in that synagogue were terrorized, wouldn't you? And Paul writes, why is the shooter not considered a Christian terrorist? That's an interesting take on this. This was an act of domestic terror. And there was another act of domestic terror that we were just talking about in the days before the massacre in Pittsburgh. That series of explosive devices that were sent by mail to outspoken critics of President Trump. Cesar Sayoc is the suspect. The latest of those pipe bombs was sent to liberal billionaire Tom Steyer, who's funded many campaigns for Democratic candidates or causes or liberal political causes. President Trump tweeted this about Tom Steyer after presumably watching Steyer appear on CNN last Sunday. Quote, just watched wacky Tom Steyer, who I have not seen in action before, be interviewed by at Jake Tapper. He comes off as a crazed and stumbling lunatic who should be running out of money pretty soon. As bad as their field is, if he is running for president, the Dems will eat him alive. Unquote. This blending of dealing with domestic acts of terror and politics, Jessica, I don't know where this goes.
Yeah, I mean,
on either side,
right.
either from the president criticizing Tom Steyer mm-hmm. or from the president's critics saying you made this happen.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one thing that I think that has been evident this week, we look to the president to be sort of a consoler in chief at times like this. And this has been one of the roles that President Trump has been most uncomfortable being, you know, whether it's, you know, been in other when other attacks have happened and different things, too. You know, Naftali mentioned his tweet afterwards, you know, it was sort of all about me and what's happening. And I think that, you know, it's shocking that he goes there. But this, again, has kind of become the norm. But I do think that, you know, I mean, it wasn't President Trump that armed him, that sent him there. And you can talk, you know, I think it's just, there are divisions on both sides, certainly, that have contributed to, I think, this heightened national rhetoric. But again, the president is the top person that a lot of people look to. And when he continues to say these things, I think it has an impact on people.
Although it was pretty clear, Wendy, we knew that the president was going to ramp up his rhetoric going right up to Election Day Tuesday. So, you know, this is kind of a piece. This doesn't really come as a shock.
That's right. And I think this new rhetoric on immigration is part of that strategy. And I think the reason he pivoted so quickly to that Roosevelt Room speech yesterday and the tweets with the ad with the immigrant cop killer and all of that was to sort of change the conversation from your rhetoric caused, you know, from what people saying that your rhetoric caused the Pittsburgh shooting or the bombs around the country. He sort of transitions from the consoler, which Jessica's right, he's extremely uncomfortable in that role. It's just not part of his DNA. To the guy who's going to fix it. Remember, I alone can fix it at the Republican convention in 2016. And so now he's the guy who's going to fix immigration, but he's using that really harsh rhetoric. These are the really harsh rhetoric.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about that. I'm glad you brought that up. We should move on and talk about immigration, particularly the president's rhetoric on immigration along the southern border. Most recently, Naftali, he floated this idea in an interview with Jonathan Swan and Jim Vanderhey of Axios of revoking birthright citizenship through an executive order. Now, this presents a fairly gigantic constitutional problem in that birthright citizenship is guaranteed by the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. So what's going on here?
Well,
I'm sorry, Naftali, I forgot to mention, he has floated the idea of doing this through an executive order, basically through a stroke of his pen alone.
Well, a couple things. I mean, on the immigration side, I think in many ways the president's trying to rerun the 2016 campaign. I mean, let's not forget that unlike most presidents, he's been in one campaign for president, and he won it. And what did he learn from that, I think? I think he learned that if you use certain kind of rhetoric, particularly about immigration, you'll win, even if everybody tells you that you're making a mistake and you'll probably lose. He has evidence, you know, to the contrary. In terms of birthright citizenship itself, it is explicitly allowed in the Constitution. And one of the things I always think is interesting is which elements of his rhetoric his own party pushes back on. And this is one that several Republicans spoke out against, in part because they very much believe in honoring the plain text of the Constitution. They were very angry at President Obama when he issued executive orders that they felt were unconstitutional. So people like Paul Ryan, for example, spoke out against this. And Paul Ryan, of course, was rewarded by being hit back pretty hard by the president himself. So you had the specter of the president, who's a Republican, and the Speaker of the House, who's a Republican, going at it a week before the election.
Just to be clear, by the way, we're talking about this first section of the 14th Amendment, which reads, quote, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof, are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. That's the first section of the 14th Amendment. So, Jessica, since it's in the Constitution, and since Schoolhouse Rock taught us, you got to amend the Constitution with a constitutional amendment, why are we paying attention to this?
I think that there is a small group of, you know, conservative scholars, and someone has told him that, hey, you can do this. And I think it goes down to these, you know, five keywords, subject to the jurisdiction of, and, you know, whether... And they have argued that the framers didn't intend to give this to everyone in a way. But almost across the board, people say, you know, this cannot be done. And the executive order, let's not, you know, you mentioned as well, he criticized Obama for doing this exact thing. And maybe it's just, okay, he got away with it. Why can't I? But it is, I mean, this is something that's that he thinks, as Naftali mentioned, that can motivate his base. But the thing I was hearing from, I mean, I'm very dialed into, I'm covering House races and Senate races as we go into this. In the House especially, I called a lot of House strategists that have run many cycles. And the thing, I mean, they were just aghast on Tuesday when he did this. They were like, this is the worst thing that could have happened. Why is he doing this? Because you have toss-up races in Florida and Texas and Arizona and California. This is just a disaster for them. And
although, one of those toss-up races, Jessica, in Georgia, the Republican candidate Brian Kemp has that ad where he says, mm-hmm. I got a big pickup truck in case I need to grab some illegals and drive them back to the border myself. To paraphrasing, but it seems like everyone's not running away from that rhetoric. Many may be, but some aren't.
On a statewide level, yeah. I think that if it's a traditionally red state, which Georgia is changing, maybe not there yet, but I mean, this could certainly play well for in North Dakota, in Missouri, in these Senate states, because the Senate and the House are operating on such a different map. This immigration strategy could help them keep the Senate, maybe even add seats. But in the House, in the suburban districts, which is where the majority of the battlefield is, and especially in districts with growing Hispanic populations, it's a disaster.
Yeah, I hear you on the difference in those races. We'll get more into that in just a minute, but it will be interesting to see if that plays into, say, Heidi Heitkamp's race in North Dakota, Claire McCaskill's race in Missouri, two Democrats who are trying to hold on. Also, at a press conference yesterday, Wendy, the president declared that he would send 5,000 troops to the southern border to assist in preventing this large group of asylum seekers, this so-called migrant caravan, from entering the country. This caravan is still a very long way away. It's about 1,000 miles, and they're going on foot. So they won't make it by the midterms, or maybe not even this year. With regards to that, Aaron tweeted, "The mere idea that the president would encourage the use of deadly force of refugees attempting to come into the U.S. along the southern border is disgusting." That is a reference to the president saying this about the rules of engagement he might use at the border.
But I will tell you this, anybody throwing stones, rocks, like they did to Mexico and the Mexican military, Mexican police, where they badly hurt police and soldiers of Mexico, we will consider that a firearm. Because there's not much difference.
We should bear in mind also that some of the networks, when the president made this announcement, did not carry him live. CNN did, Fox News did, MSNBC did not, and said, we'll monitor it and then we'll bring you developments later. Wendy, can we put some facts to what the president's talking about in terms of what the military's power is here at the border, what it can do, what it can't do? Can we just get a few of the facts?
Yes. That line really surprised me yesterday. The Border Patrol has tried in Texas when teenagers in Ciudad Juarez across the river chuck rocks at them. Occasionally, they have fired back. It has usually gone to court, and it's gone different ways, whether the Border Patrol agent has been charged with murder or not. But for the commander-in-chief to stand in the White House and say, and essentially, not technically, but to essentially say the rules of engagement are you can shoot back if somebody throws a rock at you, when their assignment is to help build tent cities and process asylum claims and things like that, they are not really there, according to the Pentagon, to shoot anybody. And I'd like to remind people that the last time there were Marines on the U.S. border, which was in 1996 under Bill Clinton, a young man was coming across a hill in Texas and he had a long cylindrical object in his hand, and a combat-hardened Marine shot and killed an 18-year-old goat herder because this soldier, Marine, is trained to kill when he sees a threat. He reacted on his training, and I fear that that could happen in this case.
Naftali, I wonder also if there are just areas of the law that would preclude this kinds of use of the military or some of the other policy changes the president has floated. He also suggested, you know, changes to where asylum seekers can request asylum at specific ports of entry. There are laws against the military doing this, aren't there? I'm thinking about one called, I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly, the Posse Comitatus Act.
Yeah, that's correct. The you're not supposed to use the military for essentially law enforcement purposes domestically. But several of the things that he's said, you know, as we've discussed, it's legally unclear how or whether he would be able to do them. But I think that just underlines that a lot of what's going on here is a broader image or message that he's trying to send. I mean, he talks about this caravan and paints a picture of hundreds of foreigners surging toward the U.S. border, and he as commander-in-chief is calling up the troops to stand in their path and to prevent the United States from being invaded. That's basically the message, and it's a lot of the rhetoric. He's used words like being overrun. He's used words like invasion. He's talked about massive tent cities. I mean, there's a very clear message that's being sent, and I think sometimes the legal details aren't the point so much as the broader picture that's being painted.
But, Jessica, if you are a Republican voter who is receiving these messages and is eager to see that the candidate you elected continue to enact his policy agenda, I wonder how we view this in light of everything else. I mean, if you're a Republican voter who's not thinking about flipping to a Democrat, this may kind of be a wash. It may not make a difference when the votes are tallied.
Yeah, I mean, he is playing to his base here, and it's the politics of fear in many instances. He tweeted out this ad this week on his Twitter feed that was sort of the Willie Horton ad times 1,000, it felt like, where you have an undocumented immigrant who was charged with a crime, killing these police officers, and come to find out this person actually was released by Joe Arpaio, came in during the Bush administration again. But it's just this fear that of the other, almost like these people are coming, and like when he dials down on the invasion, and I mean that speech was just riddled with falsehoods. He, you know, overstated the number of immigrants coming in. He said that, you know, only 3% show up, when in fact it is far more than that for their trials. And you know, but it plays to his base. It's, they hear what they want to hear.
Early voting numbers in more than a dozen states have broken records this year. As of today, more than 29 million votes have been cast, either in person at early voting locations or through mail-in ballots. That is twice the amount counted at this point before the elections in 2014, more than twice the amount. At least 17 states have already surpassed their overall early voting totals for 2014. I wonder, Naftali, how we should be viewing these numbers right now. You know, past is not necessarily prologue, but there are plenty of Democrats who want to believe that this is the harbinger of a blue wave.
Yeah, I think on the one hand, it does certainly underline just how intense this election is. And, you know, that was coming up in polls, but now we've seen some evidence of it, that this is an unusually intense and enthusiastic voter base, particularly for a midterm. You do want to note a couple things. First of all, we're still talking about maybe a 50% voter turnout, and that would be considered great for a midterm. So I think we need to keep that in some perspective. Secondly, there's this question of what experts call cannibalization. That is to say, are these people who were going to vote on election day and are just voting early, so it doesn't necessarily tell us anything about turnout, or are these people who otherwise would not have voted? And the last point I would make is that the early voting does show, I think, what for some people is a surprising strength on the Republican side. And several Democrats have taken note of that. Nancy Pelosi has made a point to try to stir up her folks and saying, look, for now, the Republicans are doing really well. We have to match that. So it's a little hard to read too much into it.
Kind of makes me wonder, as a third option, whether this means that some people are voting early because they know election day is going to be nuts and they know that there's going to be a crowd where they live.
I mean, that's possible, too. And, you know, state after state has made it easier to vote. We didn't used to, you know, this has completely changed the strategy of elections. It used to be that candidates would think very carefully about what ad they were going to run in the final days of the campaign, because everybody was going to be going into the voting booth on that first Tuesday in November. Now you really have to array your resources and your ads very differently. And that's something else that we're seeing.
Wendy, I wonder what we make of some of these close races in particular. Jessica mentioned there's a number of races that are kind of toss-ups right now. There are some key races like the Senate fight in Texas between Republican Ted Cruz and Democrat Beto O'Rourke. Tennessee, you have Republican Marsha Blackburn and Democrat Phil Bredesen. That race, it was tight a couple of months ago, and some of the polling suggests that Marsha Blackburn, the Republican, is starting to gain an edge. Every Democrat in the country was mad at Donald Trump becoming president. So one would think Democrats would be on fire for the midterms. But there are still a lot of races that are still seem to be squeakers. Why is that?
Well, I think there are as many people who are thrilled that Donald Trump was elected president and want a Congress that will keep going in the same direction he is. You know, you mentioned the Cruz-O'Rourke race, and that is really fascinating because if Beto wins, he will be the first progressive senator from Texas in 50 years since Ralph Yarbrough in the 1960s. And that would be really hard to pull off. That would be amazing. I have a feeling just in my gut that Cruz will squeeze through. But the fact that Cruz is going to squeeze through and possibly not win decisively will be interesting. And I think the early voting numbers have a big take in that. In Texas, I know that early voters tend to be Republican. Maybe they're not this time. We just don't know. That's the big mystery of early voting. Who's early voting?
How do we view, Wendy, how do we view the rise of Beto O'Rourke in Texas? There have been a lot of political analysts who've looked at states like Texas and said that it is going to trend further to the left if for no other reason than the state is increasingly Latino. It's getting younger. There's different kind of industries bringing a different demographic into the state of Texas. You know, I wonder how we read that or if it's too soon to make that extrapolation.
Well, I lived and worked as a journalist in Texas for 20 years, and I can tell you that I've heard that for 20 years, that any minute now, Texas, after the 1994 red wave in Texas, is going to go back to being a blue state. Latino turnout is dismal in Texas, and both parties have a lot of work to do to get Latinos out to vote. It is true that in the cities are becoming more diverse. They're becoming much younger. It's a millennial hotspot in Houston to move there. But the rural areas where people vote are still very white, very conservative. And I think that's the dynamic. I mean, there are the cities and then there are these vast rural areas.
Before I get to you, Jessica, one other race in Texas that's worth noting is the governor's race between Greg Abbott and Lupe Valdez, who is not only a Latina, she is an out lesbian. So if she became the governor, that would really be a very significant win in Texas. But again, you know, this is something that's been kind of, as you said, presaged for a long time.
Right. And also, I mean, there's a few other governor's races that'll be shocking and sort of history making. There is a Native American in Idaho, a woman who might become governor. And then you have the possibility of Stacey Abrams, a black woman in Georgia, and Andrew Gillum, a black man in Florida. That could really change those states.
I'm glad you brought up Georgia in particular, also Florida. But Jessica, I want to ask you about Georgia, because yesterday we had two big heavy hitters campaigning in Georgia. We had Oprah Winfrey campaigning for Stacey Abrams and kind of interviewing Abrams on stage at a rally in Marietta, Georgia, outside Atlanta. And then you had Vice President Mike Pence campaigning for Brian Kemp, the Republican, in the race. Do we have any sense of what that star power might have meant to the race, or did that just kind of deepen the supporters more deeply?
I think it really just deepens the supporters because, I mean, everything that we have seen, this is going to be an incredibly tight race. And it is one that may not be decided on election day because there is a third party candidate in the race and Georgia has a runoff rule. So if neither candidate reaches over 50%, this could be going into overtime as well. You know, I think that if I could go back, you mentioned Tennessee as well. I'm from there. This is a race that I'm, you know, personally interested in. And I think that Tennessee and Texas are two interesting cases because you also have, I think, weaker Republicans in the case. Ted Cruz is a very polarizing figure within the Republican conference itself. Tennessee sort of has this history of electing sort of pragmatic moderate lawmakers, Lamar Alexander, Bob Corker, Bill Haslam, the current governor. And this is to me a test of how far partisanship has come, because Phil Bredesen is someone who won twice statewide very comfortably. In his reelection, he carried every 95 counties. And I was down there doing a story, and one of the things he said to me is like, this is a test of, you know, if this becomes about Republican versus Democrat, I lose. And I think that that's what this race has become in the closing days. I think that Blackburn has pulled ahead by a few points, probably, because I think that it sort of shows that partisanship, I think, people have on their red jerseys or their blue jerseys on a statewide level. Tennessee is still a very Republican state and really has become, I think, even more red in the age of Donald Trump as well.
Naftali Ben-David, what about the race in Florida between Andrew Gillum, the Democrat, and Ron DeSantis, the Republican? That race got nasty in the last few weeks. It got racial, flat out racial in the last few weeks. And when you talk to Floridians, myself included, there are plenty of big issues that are really important to folks in the Sunshine State, not the least of which being the environment, red tide and algae blooms and so on, and then the environment and healthcare. And I just kind of wonder what we see this race coming down to, whether it comes down to these issues or whether it is kind of like the Tennessee race that Jessica mentioned, more what jersey do you wear into the polls?
I mean, clearly it's a little bit of both. And it was a very unusual race because the two people who were nominated were not people who necessarily tacked to the center of their parties. If anything, they were people who were more on either side of their parties. There are a lot of issues in Florida, and I was a journalist in Florida for several years as well, that are local. They care deeply about the environment, no matter where they are on the political spectrum. And they care about issues like taxes and tourism and so forth. And that's a case where it looks like Andrew Gillum has a little bit of a lead. And I think that's in part because of the racial element that Ron DeSantis has brought into the race and the way that that's kind of motivated some people and turned off others. I think the big challenge for the Democrats in general nationally, and the reason some of these races are closer than one might think, is they have turnout problems among some of their big demographics, whether it's young people, whether it's Hispanics, sometimes African-Americans. And so, yeah, you'll see these polls that show the Democrats should be winning comfortably. But then when it comes to actually coming out on election day or for early voting, that doesn't always happen.
Speaking of the polls, before we move on from elections, do we trust the polls this year? Because remember, everybody thought Hillary was going to win in 16. So should we just ignore the polls until Wednesday morning?
Pollsters that I've talked to, I think that 2016 was kind of a reckoning. And you have seen, I think, polling become more transparent and trying to educate people about what polling means. Because the polls, I mean, you have to factor in the margin of error and different things as well. So even races that were showing a close race, there was still a probability that it could have gone the other way in a way. The Daily this morning had a very good episode talking to Nate Cohn of The Upshot, and they've done a really fascinating experiment, I think. Again, House polling is often hard to come by, but they have been doing live polling in some of these House races. It really shows you. And I was skeptical of this to begin with, but it has shown a transparency that I hope educates people about how polling is done, how few respondents you get, how it is weighted. And a lot of other pollsters, Monmouth University, I think, they've also shown different turnout models, because you weight these polls based on what the turnout is going to look like. Right. So I think that they've been trying to experiment with this. Polling can give us a snapshot, I think, of what the race looks like at that moment. And that's why we see it change in a way, too.
Glad to hear from some of you about how you say you'll be voting. Aaron tweeted, I voted early because I really want my voice to be heard, but I know that Tuesday will be insane. And Donald tweeted, I'm a Republican who will not vote for anyone with an R next to their name. So sick of the extreme conservatism. Won't even do it locally. And I know some of them. We need better balance. Let's move on from the midterms. I think we're all really eager to move on from the midterms and talk about the cabinet, where the Justice Department is investigating the Interior Secretary, Ryan Zinke, on allegations of using the office for personal gain. Now, these allegations against Zinke, Wendy, have been ongoing for some time. And according to the Washington Post, there are two White House officials who say that the administration is getting increasingly concerned about Zinke's personal affairs. What exactly is the concern, and what's the potential for fallout here?
As I understand it, there is concern about his discussions with a developer or an oil and gas a company that wanted to do exploration near some land that he owns, and whether he had improper discussions with them as Interior Secretary. And I think this just goes back to the whole question of how the Trump administration didn't know how to vet candidates for the cabinet when they selected them.
Jessica?
I will say, this could kind of be swept out with the trash in a way I wouldn't be surprised by. After the midterms, you typically will see cabinet turnover. I think that this would be a convenient way for the administration to sort of push him out. Politico had reported there already sort of is someone in place, the Deputy Secretary David Bernhardt there, sort of in the same way that when you saw Scott Pruitt leave the EPA, his deputy was sort of already in place. But, you know, this has been referred to the internal watchdog, and the Justice Department is looking into it. And so, you know, this could sort of be part of this post-election exodus. You know, they don't like when their people are making bad headlines, especially. We've had a lot of that. And I think Wendy made a good point. I think that it is a lot of times these people maybe were not prepared for sort of the scrutiny. And Zinke's had a lot of, you know, discussions around himself about sort of the way he's handled the office, certainly. And so I think that it's something that I wouldn't be surprised to sort of see him pushed out sort of in maybe the post-midterm sort of blitz.
Natali?
I mean, I just think that, you know, you were talking about how we're all looking forward to moving on from the midterms. There's not going to be a lull after the midterms. There's going to be an enormous amount of people stepping down from the administration. There's going to be, if the Democrats retake the House, there's going to be new investigations, a new chairman, and there's going to be a serious leadership battle in any case within both parties. So we all might be eager for things to quiet down a little bit, but I wouldn't hold my breath.
Thanks a lot. some of us need a nap. We really need a nap. Let's get out of the politics for just a minute before we wrap up. One other story that caught our attention had to do with the infamous gang leader James Whitey Bulger. He was found dead in prison in West Virginia on Tuesday. The mob leader from Boston was 89, serving two consecutive life sentences. He was convicted in 2013 after being captured in 2011. Before that, he evaded arrest for 16 years. Whitey Bulger had been accused of being involved in at least 11 murders in addition to many other crimes. He became an on-the-books FBI informant in 1975, disappeared in 94 after he was tipped off by his law enforcement connections and lived as a fugitive with his girlfriends. One more criminal justice story that caught our attention. William Daniels, 91-year-old actor, if you ever saw that movie 1776, the guy who plays John Adams, he may be best known to some who are around my age for his role as the cranky but caring principal Mr. Feeney from the Disney Channel sitcom Boy Meets World.
I haven't always been popular with my students, but I've always had their respect.
Feeney often faced off against the smart aleck kids on the show, but this week, the real actor, William Daniels, had to once again strike fear into the heart of a troublemaker, a would-be burglar, who entered his home in the San Fernando Valley. Daniels turned on the light and scared the burglar away. After the news went public, his former Boy Meets World co-star, Eric Friedel, tweeted, quote, "Never mess with Mr. Feeney," unquote.
Yeah, I loved this story because I was an avid watcher of Boy Meets World, and I read it, and I was just like, of course Mr. Feeney would do this. He remarked in interviews, though, you know, the legend kind of grew that he, like, fought this person off or something, and when in reality it seems like he turned on the light and scared them away. But it was a smile. It was a story that brought a smile to my face this week in a very tough week of just – it was just very Mr. Feeney-like, it felt like.
Yeah, I hear that. And it has been a very tough week. And hey, listen, to those of you who have helped us out telling your stories, especially those of you in and around Pittsburgh, thank you for hanging with us this week. We know that this has been really, really hard. We're so honored you were willing to share your stories with us and speak with us today with NPR's Jessica Taylor, Naftali Ben-David of The Wall Street Journal, and Wendy Benjaminson of McClatchy's D.C. Bureau. 1A's lead sound engineer is Jake Cherry. Our digital team is Gabby Healy and Catherine Fink. To learn more about them and the rest of our team, visit the1a.org/staff. We'll dive into the international section of the Friday News Roundup in just a moment.
This episode is sponsored by CuriosityStream. If you love documentaries, then CuriosityStream will be your new happy place. From the founder of the Discovery Channel, finally a streaming service for nerds, where you can binge-watch shows on science, history, nature, and more. With over 2,000 films and series and apps on most devices, there's truly something for everyone. Try it for 30 days free at curiositystream.com/NPR and enter promo code NPR.
Florida is one of only three states that don't let ex-felons vote.
I'm 73 years old. I don't have no more criminal background. I work. I pay taxes. I'm a good person. Why can't they let me vote.
Hear why that might change on Embedded.
With Saudi Arabia on the back foot over the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi, both the U.S. and the U.K. have seized this moment to push for a ceasefire in Yemen. We've only got a few days left before we go to the polls, and the ongoing unrest in Central America is being used by President Trump to spread concerns over a migrant caravan heading slowly towards the U.S.-Mexico border. Also, Germany is looking for some new leadership, and what prompted women working at Google to walk out? All around the world. That's some of what we'll discuss today in the Friday News Roundup. And joining us here in studio to make sense of what's been going on in the world this week is Nina Maria Potts, Director of Global News Coverage at Feature Story News. Nina, welcome back to the Roundup.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Rajini Vaidyanathan is a Washington correspondent for the BBC and an anchor of BBC World News America. Welcome, Rajini.
It's nice to be here.
And Clemens Vergin is the Washington Bureau Chief for the German newspaper Die Welt. Clemens, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Let's begin in Yemen and the ongoing civil war there. It's gotten a lot more attention since the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, particularly the role that Saudi Arabia has played in the war in Yemen. The fighting there began back in 2015, and since then, there's no way to describe what's happening in Yemen short of a humanitarian disaster. But this week, U.S. officials began to call for a ceasefire. Here's what Defense Secretary Jim Mattis told an audience here in Washington on Tuesday.
Improved accuracy of bombs is still a war. So we've got to move toward a peace effort here. And we can't say we're going to do it sometime in the future. We need to be doing this in the next 30 days. We've admired this problem for long enough down there. And I believe that the Saudis and the Emirates are ready.
That's Defense Secretary Jim Mattis speaking here in Washington on Tuesday. A few hours after that, the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, issued a statement laying out specific terms for the ceasefire. Nina, what would that ceasefire look like? Do we know what any of those terms might be?
I think it's too early to tell. I mean, what we've seen, and you've indicated this, is a U-turn really by the U.S., and partly driven, of course, by the scale of the disaster in Yemen. We've seen images and evidence. The BBC has done some great reporting on this, pictures that are reminiscent of the famine in Ethiopia in the 1980s, 12 to 13 million people facing starvation. I think Yemen has raised a very interesting and very tricky moral question for the West. The U.S. likes to say that it's only been providing logistical support to the Saudi-led coalition in the name of, well, in the way of air-to-air refueling. The trouble is that if you're refueling planes that are dropping bombs on civilians, it's then very difficult for the U.S. and others to wash their hands of this. And I think the trouble has been that for years, the U.S. and the U.K. has been doing arms deals with Saudi. And basically, that was free money because Saudi Arabia was not interested in picking fights or going to war anywhere. And of course, in Yemen, it has. And I think that that really has made allies realize that there's a moral consequence to enabling that war.
Yeah, Rajini, I was going to ask you about how the UK factors into this, because on Wednesday, Britain's Secretary of State for Foreign and Commonwealth Affairs, Jeremy Hunt, joined the call for a ceasefire. How much pressure do you sense kind of growing around officials in the U.S. and the U.K. to act now? Is this still just kind of talk, or are people demanding action?
I think there is a lot of pressure. Nina mentioned the BBC coverage on this story, which I'm not just here to promote for the sake of it, but actually it's been really an eye-opening window on what is actually going on in the ground. My colleagues Olga and Nicola Karim and Lee Durant have been to places that the Western media haven't been able to access. And, you know, some of the most striking things were the pictures of children who were, you know, dying of starvation. You know, one tweet that the UN sent out last week that really struck me was that, you know, at the end of last year, something like 130 children under the age of five are dying from extreme hunger and disease in Yemen every day. And I was talking to Nicola, actually, earlier this morning, who was the producer on that story. And she said one of the biggest concerns at the moment is the port of Hodeidah, which is a really key port in terms of getting supplies and aid to some of the people who need it most. But that is going to potentially be the centre of a next offensive from the coalition forces.
This port, the port of Hodeidah, Yemen basically gets like all of its food, supplies, everything through this port. And that's controlled by the Houthi rebels, is it not?
Yes, I believe so. So I think that there is the plan for an offensive. But, you know, in Nicola's words, she said there's going to be a catastrophe and it's going to get really bad if everything centers at Hodeidah.
Clemens Varghese, give us a sense of what has been going on thus far in terms of trying to manage the humanitarian crisis. I mean, have the U.S., the U.K., other countries been making strides on the ground to try to keep the peace, help people who are caught up in this, or is the world still just kind of shrugging its shoulders?
Well, I think we haven't done enough, actually, in alleviating this crisis. And especially we, in the past, especially the U.S. government hasn't done enough in order to pressure the Saudis to sort of alleviate some of the very grueling circumstances in the Yemen war. And I think, you know, there has been a lot of criticism of the Trump administration that they were just standing behind Saudi Arabia for 2 years, without any kind of doubts or without any kind of reservations. And I think the Khashoggi killing now opens up the possibility to do what they should have done in the first place, to pressure the Saudis on a different course, and also to demand of the Saudis a sort of like exit strategy. I mean, when is this going to end? And I think now they're doing what they should have done before. They're using the leverage of the criticism around the Khashoggi killing in order to pressure the Saudis into doing the right thing.
Although it is worth noting, Clement, I hear you on that. It is worth noting that the first overseas visit that the President Trump made, he made to Saudi Arabia. And when it was one of these big moments to try to galvanize other Arab leaders, they announced they spoke about a growing, deepening relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. There's this $112 billion arms deal between the U.S. and the Saudis that Jared Kushner was involved in. So there are all these levers, Clemens, that it seems that have been pulled in the last year and a half.
Yeah, I mean, that was the sales pitch of the Trump administration, is this is going to bring a lot of jobs to the U.S., and that's why we need this. This is a good ally. We need to stand with the Saudis. And, you know, strategically, there's something to say for that. Of course, they are our allies. Of course, we have an interest in helping the Saudis keeping Iranian influence out of Yemen, which is a neighboring country. It's a strategic imperative for Saudi Arabia. You don't want a situation to develop where there is something like a bridgehead of Iranian influence in Yemen, a neighboring country, just in the same way that Hezbollah is a client of the Iranians towards Israel. You don't want that situation to develop.
Regina, did you want to jump back in?
Yeah, the only thing that strikes me with any of these things is people call for ceasefires, but the thing that strikes me is that we don't know that the Houthis are going to come to the table and actually talk. I think they're saying Switzerland, aren't they? It might be the place where they meet. We've seen this before with Syria. We've seen this with previous administrations. So, you know, how much is this lip service to try and show that, you know, the West is acting tough? How much will this actually result in something that, you know, we can call a ceasefire?
Well, that's a worthwhile question. I mean, the Houthis, you know, there's a cultural connection. There's definitely a deep religious connection around the Houthis, but they're not a government. And as far as I know, Nina, they haven't really articulated any aims to, like, win the war and take over Yemen, win the war and set new policy. They're fighting for religious reasons, for cultural reasons, but even if they lay down their arms, like, the path forward, I don't know anyone who's articulated what that might look like.
I think it's an incredibly important question. I do think that on Yemen, we have reached a tipping point. We're at a point, I think, where things have got a lot worse, a lot quicker. And you're right, the path ahead is very unclear, which makes it extremely difficult for the US and the UK and other international players to imagine that this 30-day deadline is realistic in any way. I think it's a really important point.
There's also just the optics of what's happening in Yemen, and we've seen a lot of humanitarian crises. This one struck a different kind of nerve. As Carl wrote on our website, the 1A.org, millions of children, skin and bones, the United States of America has lost its humanity. Clemens, what is it about this humanitarian disaster that finally seems to have poked through to the world's consciousness?
Let me say first that Yemen has been a very, very poor country even before the civil war. So, you know, you start with a very low baseline, and then a war and a boycott being imposed on that has immediate effect on the population, of course, and that the flow of goods is not secure into the country, also of humanitarian goods, exacerbates the crisis. So I think...
I'm sorry, when you said boycott, do you mean a blockade? There's a military blockade.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah,
okay.
A blockade that prevents a lot of goods from coming into the country. I think this is of course, I mean, it reminds, you said Ethiopia in the 90s, these are the pictures, or Bangladesh, countries like that. I mean, Yemen has been a very poor country. There was starvation in Yemen before that even. And this is just, you know, has been a downward slope since from a very low threshold already.
Nina?
I think one question to ask, and I haven't got the answer to this, is why we haven't seen mass migration flows tipping over from Yemen in the same way that we have seen with Syria and, say, Iraq at other periods of time. I mean, it seems to be still quite contained, a humanitarian disaster on Yemen's soil.
Do want to move on to other stories in a moment, but I'd like to get to this comment from Matt, who wrote on our website, the1a.org, "So we're actually putting pressure on Saudi Arabia now about the conflict in Yemen? I mean, it's good if it results in an end to all of the collateral damage, like non-combatants, including children, getting bombed, but I feel a little nonplussed. Is this a response to Khashoggi's death? Is the death of a journalist known in the West what it takes for a U.S. administration to raise the bar for involvement in an ongoing humanitarian crisis? You know, other than selling the weapons being used." Rajini, what about Matt's point?
It's an interesting point, because we can only theorize what has prompted this. I mean, some people are saying, as we said around this panel, that the Khashoggi incident has propelled this. You know, some diplomats theorizing that this could be part of a Saudi compromise to effectively rehabilitate Mohammed bin Salman after the whole Khashoggi thing. And also some people saying that ahead of the midterm elections, there's been pressure from Congress to show that they can act. I mean, the fact of the matter is, it's been more than 3 years now. So is it Matt? It makes a very good point. That why now? Again, you know, the world has shone a light on this story over those 3 years from time to time. So it's definitely political. And, you know, one can be cynical about how much it will actually make a difference.
Clemens?
I think there's much more scrutiny. I mean, the Khashoggi killing just highlighted the recklessness of bin Salman as a leader in Saudi Arabia. But, you know, we've seen this for the better part of a year now. I mean, he's taken prisoner the Prime Minister of Lebanon for some days. I mean, he of course says it wasn't the case, but we know that it was the case. He has repressed opposition in Saudi Arabia in a very ruthless way, and the war in Yemen is of his own making. So I think it just highlights criticism that experts had about, you know, the ruthlessness of this new ruler, this young and emboldened ruler in Saudi Arabia. But it's sort of like come out into the open to a wider audience and not only an expert community at the moment.
I wonder, Nina, if the point, even from what Matt is talking about, and I hear where he's coming from, I wonder if the issue is this kind of larger sense of what it means, particularly for world powers like the U.S., the U.K., and others, to be world leaders, you know, whether or not our values are still exported around the world. We heard from former Secretary of State Rex Tillerson the difference between American policies and values under the current administration and what it would take to provoke us to act. Like, until you kill someone who matters to us, we're not going to do anything.
I think that's certainly one way to view it. I mean, I'd like to perhaps return to the point that I was trying to make in the very beginning, that I think one of the issues for the West, which is problematic, it's morally problematic, is that essentially there were no apparent moral consequences for doing deals with Saudi Arabia before. And Saudi Arabia, under MBS, he is trying to put Saudi Arabia on the geopolitical map. And now that that is happening, we're seeing the U.S. sort of sit up and take notice. I think it's problematic morally.
Let's keep moving to another story that got our attention this week. We've been talking about this so-called migrant caravan coming from Central America up to the U.S.-Mexico border. Well, there's been another group of people fleeing similar conditions that has pushed into Mexico, despite a skirmish at the Guatemalan border that left one man dead. Now, this group is calling itself the Second Caravan, a reference to that other one that President Trump has been criticizing. And the president says he plans to send about 5,000 American troops to the border. He's also said that number might rise to 10,000 or 15,000. Rajini, what do we know about the caravans themselves in terms of who's in them, where they are, how their journey is coming, and what it was that ultimately inspired them to start moving?
Well, I think what we know isn't necessarily the case is what President Trump has been saying for the last few weeks, which I think it was about just over a week ago when he said a lot of them are criminals. And there's no evidence to suggest that that is the case. But this is all the reason why why the president is putting this on the agenda is because, you know, with midterm elections just days away, he wants to kind of play to his base. And I think slightly stepping away from this, you know, we all watched Donald Trump yesterday at the White House say he's going to give a big statement about this migrant caravan from the White House. But in many ways, it was no different to the many times we've seen him at campaign rallies in the last few weeks. He was stoking fear, using very fearful language, you know, almost demonizing people, saying it was an invasion, saying that people were rushing across the border. You know, we know that there are many families who are traveling. We know that people who, you know, the BBC has spoken to who are traveling as part of this caravan are trying to escape difficult conditions in their home countries. But that isn't the narrative that President Trump wants to put across. In many ways, as I say, he doesn't want to humanize these people because they're almost a political tool.
Clemens, can we put these caravans into some context? I mean, are they common? Do we know why they're happening now? What kind of context can we put around these?
I mean, it's not the first time that something like this happens. I mean, these kind of caravans have happened in the past. People fleeing, and I think what we see is a shift in how people approach the question: how do I flee from a crime-ridden, corrupt, and poor country and look for a better life? How do I go about this? Because what we usually know is there's a lot of human trafficking going on. It's very costly. It's very dangerous to get in the hand of the criminal gangs who are organizing the pathway to the U.S. and the illegal border crossing. But these people say, first of all, they don't want to come into the U.S. illegally. And secondly, they probably think that there is safety in numbers. So if they bunch up in big groups, that they're not as vulnerable to predators on the way, to criminal gangs, and it's also not so costly. So I think you've been seeing, you know, the first caravan set out with, I think, 160 people, and now we're way over 5,000. So what happens is they start somewhere, and then other people, because they see reporting about it, say, you know, oh, maybe this is the moment. I've been waiting for doing this for some years, and maybe this is the moment to actually do it and go with others in order to be safer.
Rajini?
We just talk about people crossing the border, and just something that just sprung into my head from, you know, during the Obama administration was me interviewing a little boy. I think he was 7 or 8 years old, and he'd come on his own. I think he came from Honduras, and he ended up in Maryland, and he traveled on his own. So it is interesting what you say there about how, you know, more people are traveling together now. I was, you know, horrified when I heard his story of just coming on his own. How safe was he going to be? We know this is an issue that has, you know, been a problem for President Obama as well. It's how the administration is talking about it that is quite different this time, isn't it?
Nina?
Well, I think there's an inherent problem, isn't there, that President Trump is deliberately exaggerating the size of the problem. This isn't an invasion. The numbers are not as big as he says they are. But also the Dems don't have a unified position on this. I mean, if on the extreme liberal front, you have people that really believe that just because you come from a poor country or a terrible place, you have the inherent right to live in America, that is never going to enjoy mainstream support in the United States. It's not a viable scenario. So I think that is the inherent issue, I think, between the Dems and the Trumpists. The Trumpists are certainly perhaps race baiting on this issue, but the Dems also need to unify and get to a place where they really propel mainstream support if that's the issue that they care about.
One of our listeners did comment in terms of the size of the crowd. Pat is in Birmingham, Alabama. Pat writes, let's have some perspective regarding our southern border. 4,000 people is a nice crowd in a downtown city park. How is this group of weary sojourners a threat to the entire United States? Clemens?
Well, of course it isn't. But on the other hand, you know, looking also at the European experience with the refugee flows in the recent years, there is, of course, this, I'm not saying the danger, but the possibility that this gains momentum. So the tightrope that you're walking is, on the one hand, there are legitimate humanitarian considerations. If these people really are legitimate asylum seekers, they need to get asylum. On the other hand, you don't want, you know, a sort of an effect on the whole of Southern America that suddenly everybody says, oh, maybe this is the moment for us to go. And then you will have in the future maybe really a big caravan coming out of the south. So you have to sort of manage this this problem in a way that you don't dehumanize them, but you also don't encourage really big refugee flows on the other hand.
This was one of the big political problems that bedeviled Angela Merkel for quite some time.
Exactly.
And I do want to talk about that in a little bit. With regards to asylum, there's this also this larger policy issue in terms of the potential for the U.S. to change the way it deals with asylum. Terrence is listening in Brewster, Massachusetts. Terrence writes, regarding the migrant caravan progressing northward through Mexico, they are walking. There may be a few exceptions, but as I understand it, they are on foot. What kind of progress are they making? 10 miles per day? Less? People on the news always say they are traveling towards the U.S. Let's be clear. They are on foot. They depend on the charity of those along the way as they trudge, and seeking asylum is a universal human right. Seeking asylum is never illegal. Nina, I've heard some analysis, I don't know if it's so, but that the potential for the U.S. to change its rules on asylum could violate international norms, that this could suddenly become a much larger issue if President Trump makes good on his threat.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of commentary out there on that specific issue. I mean, I would just add that, like a lot of news organizations, we sent a team down to cover the caravan. There is, by the way, some controversy over the use of the word caravan.
Yeah.
Some people object to that. We found that migrants themselves were referring to it as a caravan, so we went with that. But overwhelmingly, what our team found was that there were a huge number of families, young parents, who were fleeing, calling their, or describing the reasons for their fleeing, gang violence. There were some young men along the route as well, single men, certainly. I mean, I would again return to the point that I think President Trump is being irresponsible for claiming that America has open borders. Clearly, America does not have open borders, but the Dems equally are also disingenuous calling for open borders because there just simply isn't support for that.
Yeah, the terminology has been an interesting kind of debate throughout this. It almost feels more like an exodus than a caravan. Like they are leaving to try to find something better. Although, I will say, checked Merriam-Webster right quick. The first definition for caravan is a company of travelers on a journey through desert or hostile regions. And I think that might be a fair characterization. Though I understand why that use of terminology is very, very sensitive. Let's talk about another story, another very sensitive story that made news in the business world with regards to Google and the Me Too movement. Me Too has made its way to Google in a very big way because yesterday, workers on multiple continents staged a simultaneous walkout. Tori Voigt organized the walkout at Google's headquarters in Mountain View, California.
I am incredibly touched by the turnout. Incredibly touched by the friends and allies. Yeah. One of the proudest days of my career at Google in the past 8 years.
Last week, a New York Times investigation revealed that Google paid millions of dollars in exit packages to male executives who were accused of harassment. One executive, Andy Rubin, created the company's mobile operating system, Android. Regini, wonder what the people who are involved in the walkout hope to achieve, particularly because Google, and it has made this very well known, quantifies all of its goals. It wants to know, like, how do we measure the great values that we have at this company? What are the measurable, quantifiable objectives of this walkout?
Well, they have a number that they listed on their Twitter feed, but I think the one that's most striking for me, and I wrote an article about this yesterday, is that many people who were part of this walkout want to end Google's policy of forced arbitration. Now, just to explain that to our listeners, that basically means that if you have a case of sexual harassment, for example, you can't go to a court of law and sue your employer. So you can complain internally, you can take it to an independent arbitration process, which are often, you know, retired judges that sit on those panels. But if you want to sue your employer, go through an independent judicial process where a judge would sit and listen to that, well, you can't. Now, Google's not the only company that does that, but many people in the wake of Me Too feel that that silences people because, firstly, it means that these claims can be discussed behind closed doors, so no one knows what these accusations are. We may all remember the case of Fox News and Gretchen Carlson, who was subject to a forced arbitration agreement with her employers. And she accused Roger Ailes of sexually harassing her. And she managed to kind of get round her contract. We're not quite clear how exactly she did that, by suing him directly. And as we all know, that opened the floodgates. Other people came forward accusing Roger Ailes, who obviously died earlier this year, of sexual harassment. So in many ways, this is a really important thing for the Me Too movement. I've covered this a lot. But if you're looking at whether the Me Too movement has made an impact and what measures we can look at, yes, more women are coming forward, but are they getting the justice that they want is the real question.
Well, and that's kind of what I wondered, Rajini, is how Google responded not only to the article from the Times, the investigation, but also to this walkout. They certainly don't seem to have punched back at the employees who walked out.
No. In fact, you've got Sundar Pichai saying that he supports this.
CEO of Google.
Yes, sorry. And that's the challenge, is that if you support that, then why is this policy still in place? And it is worth mentioning that companies like Uber and Lyft and Microsoft have done away with forced arbitration in their companies. Uber, most notably, had a big scandal around this subject and so decided to remove that. So anyone who has a sexual harassment case in Uber or Lyft or Microsoft can actually now make a public case in the court. And very quickly, Microsoft is one of the companies that's actually supporting a congressional bill that's sitting in the Senate at the moment that will actually mandate that forced arbitration is illegal.
Nina, this is pretty fascinating in terms of the phase of the Me Too movement that we're in, where we're not just targeting harassers, but also the structures that protect them.
I mean, I have to say that in terms of the other demands, it wasn't a messy protest, and the objectives were really not that demanding. I mean, if you think about some of the things that the protesters and the staff were asking for, it was to have the chief diversity officer report directly to the CEO. It was to have an employee representative on the board, transparency over sexual misconduct processes. I mean, all of that seems incredibly reasonable. There's another beef with Google. Some might have preferred that there'd been a walkout over censorship. That's another issue. I don't know if you've seen reports about Project Dragonfly, which is a rumored project that Google apparently is developing, a Chinese censored search engine. I mean, that is also particularly sort of horrifying prospect.
Because you have to search Google out of Hong Kong. Like, there is no, like, Beijing-based search engine because of the censorship.
These are not confirmed reports, but Google is allegedly developing this Chinese-censored search engine. Putting that aside, I think the walkout, perhaps in broader terms, is another indication or another illustration of how the country is being pulled apart. Broadly along party lines, it seems that the Republicans don't think that this is a huge issue. Democrats do insist that they do. And I think that there is a sense that this is a tipping point for corporate culture, a sense that the dam is breaking.
Regina?
I just wanted to bring in a fact that I found out when I was researching this article yesterday. According to the Washington, D.C.-based Economic Policy Institute, more than half of U.S. employers, it's 53.9%, have forced arbitration processes in place. That is staggering. So, I mean, that's 60 million American workers who can't go to the courts to protect their employment rights.
Bar Lennon writes, what caused the drop in support for Merkel? Does it have anything to do with massive immigration? We will talk about Angela Merkel when we continue the Friday News Roundup with Nina Maria Potts, Rajini Vaidyanathan, and Clemens Vergine. And we will bid a fond farewell to something that has helped us understand this world and introduced us to thousands more. Stay close.
This message comes from NPR sponsor ADT. America's trusted home security company can help protect you against break-ins, fires, and carbon monoxide. 24/7 emergency response when you need it most. More at ADT.com.
This week on Ask Me Another, we've got actor Michael C. Hall. I chat with him about all the odd jobs he had before making it big and about his time being America's favorite serial killer on Dexter. Plus, he teases his new one-man show, Tom Paine, Based on Nothing, all on NPR's Hour of Puzzles, Word Games, and Trivia.
According to Angela Merkel, the time has come to open a new chapter. On Monday, Germany's chancellor confirmed reports that she would not run again to be the party leader. She'll remain in her position for now, but the hunt is on for a new leader. After nearly 13 years in power, her authority never recovered from a poor showing in last year's election. Recent regional losses proved to be the last straw. Barlenon writes, what caused the drop in support for Merkel? Does it have anything to do with massive immigration? Clemens Verkin, what caused this drop? Was it immigration or was there more to it?
Well, it was immigration in the first place, of course. I mean, what was perceived as their open door policy in 2015 triggered a populist movement. The party had the AfD, a party that had been around already before, but only had marginal election success. And when the refugee crisis started, it just, you know, jumped up in the polls, won elections, between 10 and 15%, sometimes 16% in some regional elections. And there was, you know, this widespread feeling that this had gotten out of hand, that Merkel had been in power for too much time, that her government had run her course. And there was also deep division inside the governing coalition between the Social Democrats and the Conservatives, which created this image of a government on borrowed time, if you want.
Can you give us a sense, Clemens, of her personal popularity versus her party's popularity? Were they kind of one and the same?
Well, she still has, she still enjoyed a huge popularity among Germans because sort of her no-nonsense, non-dramatic kind of governing style has always been popular among Germans. But there was this populist movement on the right of her conservative party, which basically ate away consensus in elections from her party. And there is this feeling inside the conservative party that her shift to the left in the last 13 years, which seemed for a long time to be a very clever governing strategy because she was just sort of embracing positions to the left of her and demobilizing voters of the left in that way. So she won election after election, or in a way that she was able to govern always as a chancellor, but that had taken out the meaning of her own conservative party, that sort of this party is now, doesn't really know what its identity is, and that there is this feeling that they had to recalibrate the Conservative Party.
And just to be clear, Angela Merkel, Clemens, is choosing not to run for re-election. She's not like term limited out or anything.
No, there are no term limits on chancellors in Germany.
So she could run again if she wanted to.
Yeah.
She's choosing not to.
Yeah.
Nina, can we zoom out a little bit in terms of Angela Merkel's importance? I feel like over the last few years, she has grown either in importance or visibility, I'm not sure what the right word is, but in terms of not just Germany, but Europe more broadly, she represents something different now that she didn't represent a few years ago.
I think the international perspective is fascinating on Merkel. She was always seen as a safe pair of hands, the grown up in the room. Some economists, though, do believe that her economic policies were flawed. They accuse her of economic mismanagement, especially when it comes to Greece. She was seen very much as the school mom of Europe, putting Germany's interests first. She's been blamed for stalling the recovery of debt-ridden countries like Greece at a time when the economy was imploding, the unemployment was hovering around 27%. But the problem that economists ignore is the political reality, which is that Germans didn't particularly see why they should work until the age of 65 in order to prop up Greece, which was guilty of embezzlement and a fraud. It lied and it cheated. It risked tearing the European Union apart itself. And Germans didn't think that they who had saved carefully should be held accountable for Greece's problems. I mean, I think the other thing about Merkel, which is really interesting, is that she was stubborn. She was cautious. And for an incredibly cautious woman, she was also a radical. And she was an incredible radical. 1 million Syrian refugees, if you just stop to think about that. I mean, it is extraordinary. It was career ending, unfortunately for her. And then perhaps a third point with her was that she's good with difficult men. Putin famously brought a dog to one of their early meetings on the basis that she had been attacked as a child, was scared of dogs. But, you know, she handled it. She's probably, you know, the most experienced old-style politician staggering onto the stage of new-style politics. So put her in a room with President Trump or even Macron. Macron doesn't even have a proper party. She's sort of surrounded by a tide of rising populism.
And speaking of that tide of rising populism, Rajini, that's also something I think that kind of set Angela Merkel apart from some of the insurgent leaders, particularly you look at the race where Emmanuel Macron beat Marine Le Pen in recent years, it looks like Europe has been very worried about this hard pull to the extreme right, and Angela Merkel kind of existed as this more conventional, pragmatic, Eurocentric politician.
Well, we all remember Angela Merkel being termed the leader of the free world after President Trump was elected. And I think the one thing that many people, certainly in the UK, will be wondering whenever she leaves, we don't know how early that will be, of course, it could be 2019, couldn't it, Clemens? But is what does that leave in terms of the EU? I mean, Donald Trump reportedly once joked that she was the president of Europe. She could be quite key when it comes to Brexit negotiations. She has been quite key. So if she goes before any deal is done with the UK, where does that leave a lot of that? Because she has really been a champion for the EU, hasn't she?
With regards to the relationship between the US and Germany, Ambassador Richard Grenell, who is the US ambassador to Germany, spoke on Fox News about President Trump's relationship with Chancellor Merkel.
They both speak very bluntly. I think there's a great respect because they also speak the same language of money and jobs and the economy. You know, one point on that is that we have asked the Germans, for instance, to increase their defense spending. They're not spending the required 2% that NATO requires members to spend. And so we've been very forceful in that. And I'm here in Germany reminding Germans every day that we're not asking the Russians, we're not asking the Chinese to increase their defense spending. We're asking our friends, the Germans.
That's Richard Grenell, the U.S. ambassador to Germany, speaking recently on Fox News. Before we keep going, Clemens, do we have a sense of who might be the successor to Angela Merkel? Are there any people kind of waiting in the wings, or is it really kind of wide open right now?
Well, there are basically three persons who are possible successors as in the party leadership. One is Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer, difficult name. She is sort of like the heir apparent, the woman Merkel wants there to succeed her. Then there's Friedrich Merz, who has been out of politics for a long time. He was sort of like once one of the young, wild conservatives, and he, you know, radical free market ideas, and but a conservative value set. His candidature is actually sort of energizing the party because they think, as I said, they think they need a recalibration of the Conservative Party, and that Merz could provide that. And then there is Spahn, who's a minister for health at the moment, who's also a very interesting guy who's more conservative than Merkel, but he could be attractive also for urban elites in some ways. So, you know, they're basically the decision is between what do we want the conservative movement to look like in the future, and there are basically three different answers to that, and it's going to be very interesting to see how that works out. I mean, Friedrich Merz, the outsider, who's been in private business for some time now, is definitely sort of like the candidate that a lot of people are putting their money on at the moment.
Let's shift gears to Pakistan, where thousands of protesters took to the streets this week. Their anger followed a Supreme Court decision to release Asia Bibi, a Christian woman who was sentenced to death in 2010 after being accused of insulting the Prophet Muhammad. The crowd is chanting in Urdu, "Friends of blasphemers deserve death," and "Prophet, we sacrifice our lives for you." Now, I wonder, Rajini, what this is all about, particularly because the people who took to the street promised to, in their words, paralyze the country and kill the judges involved if they didn't uphold Bibi's death sentence. Pakistan's prime minister upheld the court's decision. What's underlying all this?
Well, it just shows you how febrile Pakistan is at the moment when it comes to religious tensions, which is something that we've seen for decades in Pakistan. I mean, Asia Bibi was Christian. She was accused of blaspheming Islam. And, you know, even though the Supreme Court acquitted her, there's so much vigilantism in Pakistan. So there's so many people, many of those who've taken to the streets today who say they want to take action. You know, I was just looking up the figures, and I think since 1967, some 1,300 people in Pakistan have been convicted of blasphemy. Often people do take the law into their own hands. Last year there was a high-profile case of someone who was killed by a vigilante in this case. One of the wider contexts is here is we've got a new leader of Pakistan, Imran Khan, who was elected in part by support from some of these hardline Islamists, who now has to deal with this challenge. And he isn't even in Pakistan at the moment. He's actually on a trip to China. So his words will go some way in reaching out to people, but many say he's not even here dealing with this issue.
Bishan wrote on our website, the1a.org, kudos to the brave judges in Pakistan who, under death threats, spared the life of a lowly Christian farm girl accused of drinking from the same cup as Muslims and thus committing blasphemy. Man, we think we have it bad. Maybe Kavanaugh ain't so bad after all. Next door in neighboring India, there's a very lively debate about public statues we may want to see brought down here in the U.S., but India is showing the world a thing or two about putting them up. This week, a bronze statue called the Statue of Unity was unveiled in Gujarat. It is twice as tall as the Statue of Liberty. It's 600 feet, and for the time being, it is the world's tallest statue. Rajini, let me stick with you. What's the story behind this statue other than just being really, really tall?
Well, it's a statue of Sardar Vallabhbhai Patel, who's a famous Gujarati. He was actually, I think he was India's first deputy prime minister and a member of the Congress party, although interestingly enough, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, when he was chief minister of Gujarat, actually started this project, and there has been some government money that's been put into this statue. There are a lot of farmers in the state of Gujarat that say some $430 million for this massive bronze statue. It's just a waste of money when they need help. But, you know, I've lived and reported from India. You see statues of gods that are huge all over the country. And in many ways, these kind of politicians are revered like gods as well.
And we should not get too attached to this statue being the world's tallest because apparently...
Not for long.
India has plans to open another memorial in 2021 on 15 acres in the Arabian Sea that would be nearly 700 feet tall. And that one would honor a warrior king who founded the Maratha kingdom and died in 1680. Let's talk briefly about Turkey, whose President Recep Tayyip Erdogan reported that his country has approved what he describes as a comprehensive and effective operation that would target the U.S.-backed Kurdish militia in Syria east of the Euphrates River. I know that the Syria story kind of gets overlooked often, Nina, but I wonder if we could just kind of basically explain what impact that might have, why it matters that the U.S. is backing these Kurds, and what Turkey's role is in all this.
Well, Turkey's comments have definitely thrown a spanner in the works for the U.S. with this warning of a planned offensive in Syria. In very crude terms, the U.S.-led coalition, the U.S.-backed coalition fighting ISIS in Syria, it's made up of about 50,000 mainly Arab and Kurdish fighters. Turkey has issues, obviously, with the Kurdish links inside the Syrian Democratic Forces. Erdogan believes that they're linked to the PKK, the Kurdish Workers' Party, deemed a terror organization by Turkey and the U.S. And it's created real tensions between the U.S. And Turkey. They were supposed to conduct joint patrols, specifically under a deal to try and avoid clashes with Turkish forces. I think it's set against this very complex picture, of course, is the U.S.-Turkey relationship, which has changed dramatically over the last 3 weeks, in part driven by Turkey's response to the Khashoggi murder, with Turkey sort of refraining from sticking the knife all the way in. The Saudis very much in the doghouse, and Turkey has sort of returned to President Trump's embrace. But clearly, there, you know, in terms of meeting of minds on Syria, it's very difficult to see unity emerge.
One last story before we go. You know how terrible it is to run out of gas on a long trip? Imagine losing power when you're millions of miles from Earth. That is exactly what happened to NASA's Kepler telescope this week. NASA is retiring the revolutionary planet-hunting telescope because it ran out of fuel. So in the next few weeks, Kepler will receive its final command, basically a sleep command, to shut itself down. Since it launched in 2009, the telescope has helped discover around 2,600 exoplanets. An exoplanet is a planet outside our solar system that orbits a different star from our sun. Kepler's data indicate that the universe has billions of hidden planets. There might even be more planets than there are stars. This year, NASA launched TESS, the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite. TESS will continue to monitor the stars and look for more planets. Scientists estimate it could find as many as 10,000 exoplanets on the stars closest to us, and it might even advance the search for extraterrestrial life. Nina Maria Potts, Director of Global News Coverage for Feature Story News. Nina, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Rajini Vaidyanathan, Washington correspondent for the BBC and an anchor of BBC World News America. Thank you, Rajini.
Great to be here.
And Clemens Vergeen, Washington Bureau Chief for Die Welt. Thanks, Clemens.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
1A senior team is Daniel Knight, Denise Couture, Lindsay Foster-Thomas, and Gabe Bullard. To learn more about them and the rest of our team, visit the1a.org/staff. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening, and enjoy your weekend. This is 1A.